This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. One out of every six cars sold in the U.S. is a sport utility vehicle. 20 million are currently on the roads. They have ample room for gear and family. They project an image of sporty adventurousness. And their size and heavy weight appear to offer extra protection in case of an accident. But my guest, Keith Bradshaw, argues in his new book, High and Mighty, that SUVs are not only deadlier to occupants of other vehicles, they also pose grave safety risks for their own drivers, with high rollover rates and poorly performing brakes. And their low gas mileage and high emissions rate make them one of the least environmentally friendly family cars on the market. Bradshaw was the Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times from 1996 through 2001. He's now the Times Hong Kong bureau chief. In his book, Bradshaw writes that despite the gas shortages and an emerging awareness of the environment, car manufacturers started seriously marketing SUVs in the 70s. You know, when you say the 1970s, I think that's the decade that the federal government imposed all sorts of regulations on the auto industry, safety and fuel economy and air pollution controls. And it was also, you know, the oil crisis and gas shortages. It seems so contradictory that SUVs sprung out of that decade.
It is. And it's because of an interesting coincidence. American Motors bought the Jeep brand at the end of 1969. And that was the first time that a company, American Motors, really tried to position utility vehicles as family vehicles. The chairman of American Motors then had the vision that these were, that many Americans would like the off-road image. He was no longer marketing the SUV to rural customers, people who wanted to be able to use it for hunting and fishing. He saw it as a vehicle that could be sold through American Motors dealerships in every big city in the country, and he did that very successfully. At the same time, really by coincidence, you had the rise of environmental and safety pressures on the auto industry, and American Motors was the least equipped of the then big four Detroit automakers to cope with these pressures. American Motors didn't have the engineering capability to design Jeeps to meet, for example, the air pollution requirements that were coming along. And so in 1973, the Environmental Protection Agency decided that it would classify Jeeps as, quote, non-passenger vehicles. They would not be subject to the air pollution rules that were becoming increasingly stringent for cars because American Motors couldn't meet those requirements. And rather than have American Motors be driven out of business, not able to sell Jeeps and forced to rely on its dwindling car sales, instead the EPA decided to classify the Jeeps effectively as trucks. From that decision, many other decisions have flowed. For example, 3 years later, the Department of Transportation decided that utility vehicles, basically Jeeps then, would be classified as trucks for fuel economy purposes, for how many miles to the gallon they got. And that remains the case to this day. Since sport utility vehicles are allowed to get fewer miles to the gallon on average for each manufacturer, they can be a lot bigger, they can be a lot boxier, they can be a lot heavier than cars can. And that is one of the reasons why SUVs have gotten so big. In addition, if you make an SUV, or for that matter, a pickup truck, large enough and heavy enough, it's exempt entirely from the fuel economy standards. Another outgrowth of that decision to classify SUVs as trucks is that they've qualified for more lenient safety rules and for more lenient tax treatment.
Could you break down for us the economics of this market then? What the auto companies saved in expenses by investing in SUVs rather than investing in light, making cars lighter and more fuel efficient and meeting all the other requirements that were placed on cars in the 70s?
Sport utility vehicles are very inexpensive to design because most of them are still built on the same pickup truck underbodies that the automakers have been spending money to develop for decades for use by small businesses, farmers, as well as just people who like to drive a pickup. So as the SUV market boomed, automakers were able, at a very small investment, to design longer passenger compartments that they could bolt on top of pickup truck underbodies that they'd already designed. The savings can be enormous. The combined with the markups that manufacturers have been able to charge for SUVs, because they've been in such demand and the supply has been somewhat limited, so that a full-size SUV doesn't cost much more to manufacture than a mid-sized or perhaps a full-sized car, and yet you're selling something that costs $20,000, $25,000 to build. You're selling for $40,000, $45,000.
What other forces were at play in the 80s that made made SUVs a smart marketing investment for the auto industry? And I'm thinking that that was a decade of cheap gas.
Cheap gasoline made a big difference. The fuel economy rules enacted in 1975 by Congress and implemented by regulations a year later got tougher and tougher and tougher all the way through 1985. It was getting very, very hard for automakers to build large cars. Now, since then, mind you, automakers have come up with ways to make very fuel-efficient large cars, but in the mid-80s, they didn't have that capability. And so as gasoline prices fell dramatically, Americans wanted big vehicles again. The automakers couldn't sell them a lot of large cars without breaking the fuel economy rules, so they began selling them a lot of large sport utility vehicles instead. Even though they burned a lot of gas, they still met the more lenient, lower standards for light trucks.
So which came first, the impetus from the consumer for a utility vehicle that expressed this adventurous side of their personality, or was this fantasy something that the auto industry created?
I think there was a little bit of each, but certainly there was very strong consumer demand. When Jeep introduced the Jeep Cherokee in late 1983, the sales exceeded its own expectations, and each year they kept building and building and building. The marketing at the same time was also very effective in promoting an image of SUVs as vehicles that were providing this adventurous image, and often that tapped into deeper needs or worries on the part of many customers. For example, in The New York a week or two ago, there was an ad by General Motors for the Hummer. They bought the Hummer brand about 2 years ago. There was an ad for the Hummer showing a large Hummer, and it said, "Teach cabbies some respect." And there was a fake New Yorker cartoon showing a grinning driver at the wheel of his Hummer, and there was a taxi driver on either side, and they were both looking up in terror at the Hummer. The idea that you're able to intimidate other motorists, that people aren't going to get in your way, is something that tends to appeal to the SUV buyer. As GM's head of initial vehicle planning puts it, minivan buyers are people who like to feel in control of a situation, being able to do things with their vehicles like helping the elderly or what have you. SUV buyers, according to General Motors, are people who like to feel in control of others. And so that's reflected then in the marketing and the advertising.
I'd like to take a moment and talk about minivans, because they are the alternative vehicle for people who have big families and who need larger vehicles. And minivans don't come under the SUV classification. What are the safety and fuel efficiency records for minivans in comparison to SUVs? Are they a desirable alternative?
Well, minivans in many ways are tall cars. They're built like tall cars, and they tend to be more fuel efficient. They provide a lot of room inside. They don't have the high floor that you get in an SUV. The floors in SUVs are high in order to accommodate the off-road travel, so you get more usable room in a minivan. In my book, I praise large cars, which also provide a lot of room, as well as minivans. If you look, for example, at the current Chrysler Concorde, which is a full-size car, it offers as much interior room as a 1978 Chrysler New Yorker luxury sedan. It's a roomy, comfortable vehicle. It gets close to double the gas mileage of that Chrysler New Yorker sedan. In fact, the current Chrysler Concorde gets roughly the gas mileage of a 1978 Dodge Omni subcompact. So the fact is, there's been tremendous progress made by Detroit in improving the fuel economy of cars. However, what are people buying these days? They're buying Dodge Durango medium-sized to large full sport utility vehicles, and the Dodge Durango gets exactly the same gas mileage as that 1978 Chrysler New Yorker sedan.
Can you put SUVs in some context for us in terms of what their economic importance has been to the auto industry in the past decade? Just how profitable are they for the industry?
SUVs are important not just to the auto industry, but to the entire American economy, which is why I suggest caution in how the problems of SUVs are addressed. SUVs are extremely profitable and have done wonders for Detroit. The profit margins range from $6,000, $8,000 often on a mid-sized model to as much as $12,000 or $15,000 apiece on a full-sized luxury SUV. By contrast, automakers make almost nothing on their cars, small profit margins on their minivans, and only slightly larger margins on their pickup trucks. By taking a $20,000 or $25,000 work pickup truck and adding a lot of chrome in a larger passenger compartment for an extra $1,000 or $2,000, you can turn a humble pickup truck into a $40,000 SUV. So the profit margins are big. That's made a difference because the auto industry remains one of the cornerstones of the American economy in a way that many people on the coast don't appreciate. For example, GM and Ford are the only two companies that each still account for 1% or more of the American economy's output. Each of them still has more than seven times the sales of the Microsoft Corporation. Each of them is still bigger than the entire American airline industry. And these are immense enterprises that have been brought great prosperity by the boom in sport utility vehicles. That prosperity has then spread to the workers and to much of the upper Midwest. I mean, housing prices in the Detroit area, for example, rose three times as fast as the national average during the 1990s.
My guest is Keith Bradshaw. He was the Detroit bureau chief of the New York Times from 1996 through 2001. He's been with the Times since 1989. Bradshaw is currently the paper's Hong Kong bureau chief. He has a new book about the history of sport utility vehicles. It's called High and Mighty. Keith, we're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We're back with New York Times reporter Keith Bradshaw. He was the Detroit bureau chief for the Times from 1996 to 2001. He has a new book about the history and safety record of SUVs. It's called High and Mighty. Let's talk about safety and SUVs. When did safety concerns start cropping up with these vehicles? What were the early red flags?
Well, there were concerns about rollovers, for example, all the way back to the 1970s. There has been improvement, certainly, in SUVs since then, but as rollovers remain a greater problem for SUVs than they do for cars. Three-fifths of the deaths in SUVs are caused by rollovers compared to one-fifth of the deaths in cars.
I think a lot of SUV drivers believe, though, that rollovers are only a problem if you're driving recklessly and fast, and it's not a problem for your average responsible driver. Are they misguided in that?
Driving in a safe, responsible manner is absolutely the best way to avoid getting in trouble in the first place. However, what a lot of people don't realize about SUVs and rollovers is that most of the rollovers do not happen because somebody is zigzagging down a paved road. They tend to occur, in more than 90% of the cases, in fact, when the vehicle is tripped. That is, it nicks a curb, for example, or it strikes a lower riding vehicle, or the wheels on one side are in the dirt or gravel of a soft shoulder. Something that stops the wheels or slows them sharply on one side of the vehicle can cause a rollover. And even a good driver can sometimes make a mistake that will cause a vehicle to slide or turn into a curb. Now, a car can also roll over if it hits a curb. The only concern is that the higher the center of gravity relative to the width between the wheels of the vehicle, the more susceptible it is to rolling over when you do find the vehicle being tripped.
Over the years, have things changed in SUVs construction to make them less prone to rollovers or more prone? I'm thinking there are more and more SUVs that are taller and bigger.
The larger, heavier SUVs seem to roll over less often. They have just a lot of weight to hold them down. In addition, the automakers have begun introducing electronic stability systems on some of the larger models that make it less likely that you're going to start sliding into a curb or start sliding onto that shoulder or start sliding into a guardrail in the first place. So there has definitely been improvements. But that said, at the same time, we're selling, or the United States auto industry is selling more and more SUVs. And so it's a constant race between the rising number of SUVs and the industry's efforts to make SUVs closer to cars in terms of stability and safety. Overall, the number of rollovers is rising.
I think people who drive SUVs think they're safer in them for a number of reasons. They think four-wheel drive is safer, and I'm thinking of those ads where the SUV is driving fast down the road and then it stops on a dime to avoid hitting an armadillo or a frog or some such thing. There's this idea that four-wheel drive somehow means better traction and better braking. Where does the research come down on that?
Traction and braking are often related, but the thing to remember about four-wheel drive just means that the engine is providing power to turn all four wheels instead of just the front wheels for a front-wheel drive car or the rear wheels for a rear-wheel drive car. Four-wheel drive does not help you stop. In fact, if anything, SUVs have longer stopping distances than cars. Four-wheel drive can even be dangerous to the extent that people feel like they can go faster without slipping and sliding because it does help you accelerate. And then you can end up in a very dangerous situation if you don't realize that you have no more brakes than the cars that are slipping and sliding around you. The person in a car who goes out on a wet or slippery or icy or snowy morning and is sliding two or three times coming down the driveway and getting onto the street is probably going to drive carefully and know that they might have a problem with the brakes. The person in an SUV who doesn't slip and slide as they're trying to accelerate might not realize that the traction and braking ability is not very good until they actually need the brakes, and then they could have a problem. The owner's manuals warn about this problem that four-wheel drive doesn't improve braking ability. But even the auto industry's own executives acknowledge that the message may not be getting out to people, that four-wheel drive does not help your ability to stop.
What about this idea that you're better protected, though, by a bigger, higher vehicle than you would be by a car in an accident, in the case of an accident? And that's, again, why a lot of people buy SUVs.
What's important to remember is that the death rate for SUV occupants is as high or slightly higher than it is for car occupants. The extra bulk of an SUV does provide some benefit in a collision with another vehicle. However, it increases the likelihood of death or injury for the other motorist by far more than it decreases your risk. What's more, half of all deaths in traffic accidents are single vehicle accidents. Everybody assumes, well, that can't happen to me. But anybody can make a mistake, and an SUV is a less forgiving vehicle in which to make a mistake.
You're right that the safety situation with SUVs is bad now, but that this is just beginning. What are some of the factors that you're alluding to that might contribute to making the problem deadlier?
SUVs are about 25% of the vehicles sold now. There are only 2 or 3% of the vehicles being scrapped right now. So the number of SUVs is going to become dramatically greater. Right now, there are about 10% of the vehicles registered in the United States, and we're probably going to see that double over the next 10 or 15 years. At the same time, the people who drive SUVs are beginning to change. The first drivers have tended to be middle-aged families who are the most cautious drivers. They still have excellent hearing and vision. They are still physically robust so they can survive the collisions themselves, and they tend to be very responsible people. They also tend not to be out driving at 3 a.m., which is when accidents are particularly likely to occur. The danger will come as more of the used SUVs fall into the hands of teenagers who can't afford better vehicles. And then separately also, as more SUVs at some point fall into the hands of drunk drivers. There have been studies finding that drunk drivers tend to drive the cheapest vehicles available, and there are very few extremely cheap used SUVs available. The demand has been so strong for new SUVs that that has, at least until recently, held up the prices for used SUVs, so that if you want a $1,000 clunker, you can't find it as an SUV, you can find it as a car.
Keith Bradshaw's new book is called High and Mighty. We'll continue our conversation about SUVs in the second half of the show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's continue our interview about the SUV with journalist Keith Bradshaw. He was the Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times for 5 years until 2001. He's now Hong Kong bureau chief for the Times. His new book, High and Mighty, is a biography of the sport utility vehicle. Bradshaw argues that SUVs are among the most dangerous cars on the road today. I found it interesting that you write that SUV drivers die differently than other motorists in accidents. What do you mean by that?
Well, they're far more likely to die in a rollover as opposed to in a collision that takes place on the flat, as it were, that is, with each vehicle keeping all four wheels on the road. Whether it's a rollover on hitting another vehicle or whether it's a rollover because they're tripped by a curb or a guardrail or whatever it might be. The other risk that people need to be aware of in connection with rollovers is paralysis. Rollovers are something like 2% of traffic accidents, a quarter of all traffic deaths. There are more deaths than side impacts and rear impacts combined. And there's something like 3/4 of the paralysis cases in traffic accidents. Now, why would that be the case? It's because a rollover is particularly likely to put strains on the neck and spine that can result in paralysis.
This is really a cautionary tale. Why don't we know more of this? I feel like I keep up with car research. I'm interested in it, interested in safety on the roads. I don't know a lot of this. Has the press not covered these issues?
There has been some coverage, but there has been such an enthusiasm for SUVs and such massive advertising and such coverage of just the enthusiasm of the boom that it hasn't always been as visible. In addition, the way the automakers prepare the reviews of the quality of their vehicles by reporters tends to result often in an assessment that's not the same kind of assessment you'd make of a car. To explain, they take plane loads of journalists to places like, just south of the Grand Canyon when the Explorer came out. Land Rover's taken people up to Hudson Bay and even to Outer Mongolia. And the test drives that they offer emphasize a lot of off-road driving as well as driving on highways. It's not a very good or proportionate representation in terms of how much time you spend driving. It's not a good representation of the kind of real-world driving conditions that most motorists find. If the SUVs were tested under the same kind of conditions that cars are tested, which is usually driving around a big city or driving around a lot of tight turns in the mountains, then I think the SUVs would tend to get less favorable ratings.
Have you gone on any of these trips?
Sure. I went, for example, on the introduction of the new completely redesigned 2002 Ford Explorer in November of 2000. And it was, frankly, a fun trip. The New York Times was reimbursing Ford in my case, but we went out to Phoenix. We had the earlier model of Ford Explorer to drive up into the mountains, which were absolutely beautiful at that time of year, past the saguaro cactus with upstretched arms. We listened to some presentations about how the new vehicle was better. We then were able to drive the Explorer and a bunch of other often very expensive SUVs through the woods, Mercedes and so forth, the kind of luxury SUVs that you wouldn't be driving normally on an arduous off-road course. But that was a big part of this assessment program, was how they could wallow through the bogs and so forth. Then Ford took us all to a beautiful resort that was, as I recall, $325 a night, even in the off-season in November. We had our three- or four-room suites, and we had a fabulous dinner under the stars with chefs serving us venison and duck pate and so forth. There was an astronomer there with a very large fixed telescope through which we could admire the moons of Jupiter. There were cowboy musicians singing songs for us. While we were all done wallowing through the mud and so forth in the explorers and other vehicles, the Ford crews were driving the vehicles overnight down to Phoenix for the next crew of journalists to test in the morning. They stayed up all night in order to wash them and get them looking good as new, check out all their mechanical details so that they were ready for the next day's crew of journalists. We then drove down out of the mountains the next morning in the Mercury Mountaineer. So it was a lot of fun, but it was not necessarily representative of the way that most people are going to drive these vehicles.
Keith Bradger, thanks very much for talking with me today on Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me on.
Keith Bradger's new book is called High and Mighty. Bradger is the Hong Kong bureau chief for the New York Times. This is Fresh Air.